Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two segments today, unusually long ones, so I'm going to have to keep it unusually short. In seconds, we'll hear from Christy Thornton on Mexican politics in the run-up to the July elections. And at the bottom of the hour, the urban theorist Richard Florida will review the spatial dimensions of inequality. First, Mexico. On July 1st, the country will elect a president, a congress, and officials in 30 of its 32 states. The leading candidate for president is Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known universally as AMLO, a man of the moderate left who strikes fear into the hearts of elites in Mexico and abroad. Here's Christy Thornton to explain it all to us. Christy Thornton was executive director of NACLA, the North American Congress in Latin America, from 2005 to 2009. She's now an assistant professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins. Christy Thornton. Mexico is facing a presidential election. When's it happening?
It's on July 1st, and it's actually not just a presidential election. This is going to be the biggest election in Mexican history. There's something like 3,400 offices turning over in Mexico this year. So not only the presidency, but every seat in Congress and lots of local sort of municipal, mayoral, governor elections as well. So July 1st, election day in Mexico City and Mexico as a country is just going to be just a massive undertaking.
Why so many? Is this a coincidence or is something structural happening?
There have been some reforms over the last few years that have kind of changed how the elections happen and how they're organized. And so this is just the first time that they're coming together in this way.
Yeah. The leading candidate, Obrador, is a leftist who's been around for a while. Give us his bio.
Yeah, so Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he's called AMLO. His initials in Spanish. Everybody just refers to him as AMLO. He has been around for a while. This is the third time he's run for president. He was the mayor of Mexico City.
He was fairly successful, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was a well-regarded mayor of Mexico City. It is a difficult position because until very recently, Mexico City was not a sort of formally independent entity. It's just the federal district, like the District of Columbia. So the control of the federal government versus the sort of local mayor is something that is a new development, and that has since changed. They wrote a new constitution for Mexico City, but he was a pretty successful mayor of Mexico City. You know, he had opposition from the left, opposition from the right, but, you know, put in place a number of policies that people generally regard as successful. He ran for president in 2006, again in 2012, and now again in 2018, the Mexican presidential elections every 6 years.
And those two previous elections are pretty smelly, weren't they?
Well, so 2006 was definitely fraudulent. 2006 was the election where he lost to Felipe Calderón from the right-wing National Action Party, the PAN, and he lost by less than half a percentage point in that election. Observers could point to any number of irregularities. I was in Mexico for an election last summer at the gubernatorial level, and the irregularities that I saw were just straight out on the street, very open. So in 2006, he lost by less than half a percentage point. And so he said that the election was fraudulent. He refused to concede. And then he occupied the center of Mexico City for months and months. He sort of instituted a parallel government as a social movement force, staged this plantón, this sort of occupation of the center of Mexico City, and really kind of shut down the city for a while. And that earned him some enemies because it became difficult to sort of begin governing, but also to just move around the city. And so people got tired of López Obrador. So when he ran again in 2012, he was defeated much more soundly by the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, who is from the party that governed Mexico for 70 years before losing in 2000.
Parenthetically, the presidency of Mexico is one term, 6 years, right?
One term, 6 years, no re-election. That has been in the Constitution since the revolution. So you can only be there for that 1 6-year term and not serve again, yeah.
And then the most recent loss was?
So the most recent loss was, you know, he still understood that there was fraud and there were still irregularities in the election, but it was a more decisive victory for Peña Nieto. Now, that said, the decisiveness was that Peña Nieto got 38% of the vote. Mexico has a sort of first-past-the-post system. There is not a second round. And so with a number of candidates running, it's difficult to get a plurality. And to get a majority is very difficult. So that's one thing that Andrés Manuel López Obrador is facing now, is if he wins, will he have more of a mandate than Peña Nieto had, who only got 38% of the vote and came in already incredibly unpopular?
Well, let's step back in history some. He started out you kind of had to in Mexico, right? In the PRI.
Yes.
Which was, you know, it was a one-party state then.
Exactly.
And then he split off with Cárdenas to create the PRD, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in 1988, there was this famously fraudulent election in Mexico. Mexico, as you said, was long a one-party state, ruled by the PRI, basically, from the predecessor of the party in 1929 all the way up until 2000.
Marvelous name, Institutional Revolutionary
Party. Institutional Revolutionary Party, right? And so the revolution, the party, the state, the government, they were all one thing. Everything was controlled through the party in that way. And so in the 1980s, in the 1970s, really, there started to be democratic opening. After the massacre in 1968 at Tlatelolco, the government really realized, the PRI realized that it had this kind of legitimacy problem. And so the subsequent president, Luis Echeverria, began to do some democratic openings. So there was contestation at local levels in elections for the first time. The main opposition party had long been the PAN, the right-wing sort of Christian Democrat business party, the National Action Party. But they had functioned as a kind of loyal opposition since the 1940s. They basically were there to make it look as though there was a democracy, but essentially voted along with the PRI, you know, 99% of the time. In the 1980s, when it came time for this election to happen in 1988, there was this surge within the PRI, from the left wing of the PRI. They were called the New Democratic Tendency. And so the left wing of the PRI began pushing for further openings, further reforms. And after this election in 1988, which brought Carlos Salinas to power, and that the fraud there was massive and overwhelming. It was this incredible moment where it became clear when Salinas was losing to Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, they actually shut off the computers that were counting the votes. They just unplugged them, like literally just unplugged out of the wall. The party came out and the electoral authorities said, se cayó el sistema, the system has failed, the system is down, right? And so after the system was down, miraculously, they plugged the computers back in and surprise, Salinas won. So this was obviously fraud. And Salinas actually subsequently admitted that it was fraudulent. Like after he was out of the presidency, he came out and said, yes, we rigged that election. So this rigged election in 1998 really causes this massive split within the PRI. And that's when the Party of the Democratic Revolution, the PRD, is founded. And Andrés Manuel López Obrador, together with Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, the son of the kind of revolutionary hero, Lázaro Cárdenas, they split off and they start this new political party. The PRD wins some governorships, some, you know, local municipal mayorships, but again, doesn't, you know, they contest power. López Obrador runs for president in 2006 and 2012 under the banner of the PRD, but they never sort of make it all the way. And then what happens in recent years with the PRD is that it really it came to function basically exactly like the PRI. So because it was this offshoot of the previous party and of the institutionalization of the corruption in that party, it sort of came to function in exactly the same way. So there was an ideological spectrum within the party, even though it was supposed to be the left party, right? You had sort of right-wingers within the left party. And that was a faction called the Chuchos. And they really came to run the party. The party leadership is run by this right-wing faction. And when Peña Nieto comes to power, they basically ally with him. He creates this legislative pact between the three major parties, the PAN, the PRD, and his PRI, called the Pacto por México, the Pact for Mexico, to push forward his neoliberal reforms that he's been doing since he came into office in 2012. And those were basically to try and wipe out any last vestiges of sort of state protections and state-run enterprises that existed. So now privatizing the oil company further has been really important in that.
Now, as I recall, I used to follow Mexico fairly closely. I lost track of it in recent years. But all the reforms, the neoliberalization that came after the debt crisis, NAFTA, all this stuff, didn't that undermine a lot of the structures of the PRI's power?
It absolutely did. So there's a really interesting sort of confluence that happens in beginning in the late 1980s, when you have the beginnings of the neoliberal reforms. And so those take away of a lot of the privatization of state-owned enterprises. That takes away a lot of the kind of structures of power and clientelism for former pre-sort of centers. At the same time, you have this democratic opening, so you begin to have democratic contest in places. So the PRI loses these sort of important modes for clientelism and state patronage at the same time that there begin to be these democratic contests. And that's actually also the moment when narco-trafficking really hits Mexico as well. And so those three things really come together in the late 1980s into the 1990s. Neoliberalism, the quote-unquote democratic opening, and the beginning of the kind of surge in drug trafficking in Mexico really all come together. And so that creates massive destabilization for the PRI, absolutely. The left party in the PRD really tries to contest that, but they are eventually taken over by this kind of right-wing faction. So by the time we get into the Peña Nieto administration, there isn't a good kind of left opposition to his further neoliberalization because the PRD has signed this pact with him. They're in with him. So that's when AMLO splits with the PRD. And that's the important context for this election, is that López Obrador is now not running in the left party, the PRD. He has created his own party. After the 2012 election, and then especially after the Ayotzinapa crisis, which happened in 2014 when those 43 students were disappeared and most likely killed by the government, that happened in a state and in a municipality that were governed by the PRD. So it caused this huge crisis of legitimacy for the left party. So AMLO left, and Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas left, actually, as well. So the founders of the party sort of tore up their party cards.
Now, Cárdenas now is a grand old man, right? He's like 85.
Yeah, he's an old man, and he's still very much a kind of doyen of left politics, right? He can still sort of hold forth, and he gives these lectures, and when he pronounces on something, it's very important for the left in Mexico. So López Obrador forms his own party. It's called the Movement for National Regeneration, Morena, in its Spanish acronym. And it starts as kind of his social movement, and then he makes it into a party in 2014. This election is really interesting because we have the PAN, the PRD, and the PRI, the three traditional parties, but then we also have Morena as this kind of outside force. And that has kind of scrambled and reconfigured party alliances and what's going to happen vis-a-vis sort of the party configuration in Mexico now.
I was just looking at some of the World Bank indicators, you know, for Mexico, and on paper or on the screen, they look pretty good. Like decent growth rates, high degree of inequality, pretty high, but not as unequal as Brazil. The economy seems to be working by conventional measures. How does that comport with reality?
What most Mexicans understand about the economy is mediated through that inequality that you mentioned. There is a sense that some people are doing very well. And if you're in Mexico City, for example, the gentrification is very clear. There's a kind of new booming tech sector. Tourism is doing very well. And then the maquila industry in the north, the kind of manufacturing that's export oriented, right? The openness to the U.S. economy meant that there was a crisis in 2008, but in the U.S. recovery, Mexico has also recovered. On the aggregate, yes, Mexico's economy is doing well, but the inequality is really staggering. In the countryside, especially, there's very little opportunity. We've seen that since NAFTA, right? The sort of massive inflow of people into the cities because
NAFTA really hammered the Mexican ag sector, right?
Yeah, exactly. Agriculture was really decimated, and particularly small and medium scale farmers and things like corn, right? They just can't compete with U.S. agricultural subsidies. Our farm bill, allowed to exist in this kind of free trade framework, is something that Mexican analysts point to all the time, that we continue to subsidize here in the United States corn and soybeans and these kinds of things while demanding unsubsidized agriculture in other places. And in Mexico, that has been massively important. So you see these people flow into the cities and what they call the informal economy, right? People who don't work in normal salaried jobs has just exploded in Mexico. So people who sell things on the street, people who clean under the table, and then wages are really stagnant. So the Mexican minimum wage is among the lowest in Latin America. I mean, Mexico is a pretty developed country and its minimum wage is incredibly low. When China entered the WTO in 2000-2001, that was a big blow to Mexico.
As I recall, Mexico had just bought into this major export model, and then China comes online.
Exactly.
And then they're screwed, right?
And so this is a really interesting moment because now we've begun to see the Chinese wage come up further. And so you've actually seen the Mexican wage kind of deteriorate, stagnate, with regard to now the Chinese wage is rising. And so people think about low wages, they think about inequality, they think about massive informal work in the cities. And so people experience the Mexican economy in a way that is probably pretty different from what the kind of macro indicators might indicate. Yeah.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Christy Thornton.
And then add to that corruption and violence.
Those are the two huge problems. And so there is very much a sense that corruption is one of the ways that the Mexican economy fails. And that this is because the idea is that there's a kind of saying in Mexico that a poor politician is a poor politician, right? If you're in office and you're not making a ton of money, you're doing something wrong. So there's very much a sense that the government is there to enrich people who are in the government and their cronies and their friends and the sort of business people that they're in hock with. And then on the other side, the narcos that they're in hock with, right? So there's very much a sense that Mexico could be doing much better if there wasn't this kind of rampant corruption. And that's actually probably López Obrador's main platform, is changing that poor politician is a poor politician mode of functioning in Mexico.
And that's the central point of his popular appeal.
That is absolutely the central point, right? His economic policies are pretty middle of the road. He has, you know, tried to reinsure international investors. Generally, he's not making sort of radical economic claims. And actually, his platform uses the word austerity, which was really surprising to a lot of people. You know, Jeremy Corbyn went to Mexico City and met with him, and they sort of had this like photo op. And then his economic platform uses the word austerity, and people were like, how do we understand this? But what López Obrador means by austerity is cutting out this government corruption, that is the idea that the government is there to enrich the people in it. And so what he wants
austerity for people who deserve it.
Exactly. So he wants to claw back the way in which the government is used as a vehicle to make people rich. And so when he uses the word austerity in his platform, that's what he means. He means not using government spending to, for instance, one of the scandals in Peña Nieto's term has been having this house built for his wife by a government contractor, right? So the use of government contractors to get kickbacks and that sort of thing is exactly the kind of corruption that is AMLO's central platform, because people are so frustrated with this kind of corruption and also with the violence that comes along with the militarized drug war. That's really his central platform and his central idea. And that's why he has the support that he has, which some polls put as high now as 47%.
Of course, the right is painting him as the next Chavez, right? And bringing up fake news and Russian meddling and all that business, right? So is that desperation?
Yeah, there's a funny meme in Mexico, which is every time there is a terrible news story. Like recently, there was this really horrifying story of these three young film students who were disappeared. The government has said that they were kidnapped by narcos and that their bodies were dissolved in vats of acid. It's just the kind of thing where, you know, that has become normal. People don't even blink. But when something like that happens, there's a meme that ripples around Mexican social media, which is, ay, pobre Venezuela, right? The idea that, like, there is this idea that Venezuela is so bad off, right? But these crazy things are happening in Mexico, just this insane level of violence and corruption. And people are fixated on Hugo Chavez and fixated on Venezuela, right? So the idea is that the AMLO's opposition, who continually brings up Hugo Chavez, continually raises the specter of socialism, is actually just a deflection from the very real, very intense problems that are happening in Mexico that are in some ways much worse than things that are going on in Venezuela, right?
Now, if the polls are correct, this is going to be a very hard election to steal, right? It's not close like the earlier ones.
Yeah, it's not close. And it's especially not close for the PRI's candidate. So the way that the polls look right now is López Obrador is far and away the front runner. He has a double-digit lead. The second place candidate is this guy, Ricardo Anaya, who is a technocrat, you know, PhD from the United States. And he's running on this very strange, although not so strange if you understand what has happened in the last few years, coalition between the PRD, the left party, and the PAN, the right party. They got together and they said, okay, we're going to run one candidate together. And so he is the second place, this left-right coalition. He's very young. He's, in that way, he doesn't have a kind of long history of corruption or anything behind him.
So the Mexican Macron.
Yeah, exactly. And Peña Nieto was supposed to be exactly that, right? And has governed so badly. And then the pre-candidate, José Antonio Meade, is far, far in third place. And there are some independent candidates as well who will have a couple of percentage points of spoiling, but the PRI's candidate can't get out of the teens in the polling. yes, it will be hard to steal this election from AMLO. But two questions have been raised in recent weeks. One is the specter of assassination, which a kind of provocateur columnist in Mexico, kind of famous columnist, sent out a tweet saying maybe somebody should assassinate AMLO, and was promptly fired from his job at Televisa, which is really impressive because that sort of thing doesn't actually happen very often in Mexico. So the specter of assassination of AMLO, there has been massive violence in these elections. 88 candidates have been killed at various levels already. So it's not kind of an idle threat. But the other thing is the idea that Mead might withdraw or have a secret pact or throw in his weight behind Anaya, the candidate of the other two major parties, in an attempt to try and face down López Obrador, right? So if Anaya has 30%, Mead has 16%, López Obrador has 47%, right? If the two of them kind of throw their lot in together, they might get close enough. And it's not clear what that would look like, how that would happen. Mead said yesterday, I'm not stepping down, I'm not leaving the election. But Anaya said publicly on television, you know, I would be open to talking to Peña Nieto about working with the PRI. So in that case, you have the three major parties. You have the candidate running on the PAN PRD ticket saying he's open to talking to the PRI. It's this anything but AMLO. It is this all out.
The ruling class is terrified.
The ruling class is terrified.
I mean, his political platform is not terribly radical, as you said, but it's just they're afraid he's going to shut down the corruption.
I wonder. I think that that must be part of it. I think that it is that he's out of pocket, that they can't control him in the same way, that there is not the same kind of network of patronage and corruption. And so it's
not
interesting.
One of us.
He's not one of them, right? And so in some ways he is. As you said, he came through the PRI. He's been in government for a long time. It's not like he's some wild outsider who, you know, exists outside of these realms of power. But I think it's very much the idea that he's not controllable and that he doesn't exist in one of these party structures that is controllable, right? All three of the major parties have proven that they are available to, or they're amenable to, the neoliberal agenda. And while AMLO has not said anything really radical on the economic front, he's not part of that in club. Really,
so
just
keep
yesterday.
Keep the financiers happy and pocket a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's the model for all the three established parties, right?
Right, exactly. And so the and pocket the money for yourself, for your family, for your party members, and send a lot of it to the United States, you know, launder the money by buying houses in Los Angeles and Houston and Miami. So that level of corruption, I think, is something that the Mexican business class does really rely on. And a lot of that is very much imbricated with the way in which the economic and financial opening between the United States and Mexico has happened. There is a sense in which this kind of free trade, open financial borders between the two allows that kind of corruption to happen. And the idea is that they don't know what AMLO would do for that. They can't control AMLO in the same way. So just yesterday, this coalition of 400 sort of business leaders wrote this letter and came out and said that basically they will do anything to keep López Obrador from being elected. And so it's this interesting disconnect because he has spent this entire campaign, he's been campaigning for a long time now, moderating his stance, signaling to investors that their investments will be safe in Mexico, that he's going to more or less sort of stay the course. And yet you still have the business class running around with their hair on fire.
And what's your guess as to what's going to happen?
Oh, so I'm going to Mexico for the elections on July 1st. We'll be there for a couple days before and a couple days after. One thing that I'll say about it is that I feel very lucky that I'm not Mexican and I don't have to choose, right? Because it's a very conflicted. My friends on the left in Mexico feel very conflicted about this. There are people who are purely behind AMLO who think, yes, he's the only candidate who can make a change. And I think that that's true. I think that obviously none of these other candidates are going to make a change. But there are many on the left who really feel like he's made a lot of political compromises over the course of this campaign. Again, as the sort of strange bedfellows in the PAN PRD, Morena allied with this right-wing evangelical party called Social Encounter, Encuentro Social. And the idea there was that they're very strong in some areas where AMLO is very weak geographically in the country. So you have these kind of strange bedfellows, and that makes some leftists in Mexico say, like, what the hell is this? He's brought in some sort of important business leaders, some people who are very antithetical to a kind of left-wing agenda. And so that kind of vacillating has made some people on the left pretty nervous. So there is a strong sense that the only chance that there is for change is with AMLO. And I think that barring a catastrophic event, he will win. The thing that I spend a lot of my time worrying about right now is what happens if AMLO wins and change is too difficult to bring about, right? With the drug war, the militarization of the drug war, cooperation with the United States, NAFTA, change will necessarily be slow and difficult. And so if AMLO wins and there isn't the kind of change that people really hope to see, I think that that's a dangerous prospect in Mexico, where democracy is kind of, it's pretty fragile. And it's this new, it's kind of a new phenomenon. And so I'm really glad I don't have to vote in this election, that I don't have to make that choice. And I think people will vote for AMLO, and I think he'll win. But I think that the road toward change after that happens is a really uphill battle.
That was Christy Thornton, an assistant professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Everybody sing the same song. It goes tonight, 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 tonight. I never realized tonight. These artists thought so much about dying. But truth be told, we all have the same end. Could make you cry, 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 cry. But I'm telling you, this is the best news you're getting all week. Oh, sure, it's ruling the airwaves. But what remains of the airwaves? And we're frankly thankful for the market psychology you're hipping us to. And all the hits are saying the same thing. There's only tonight, 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 tonight. Man, life is finite. But shit, it feels like forever. It feels like forever.
That was some of Tonight by LCD Sound System. Next, Richard Florida. Richard Florida, director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto, is a deeply controversial figure who got famous for his theory that a creative class of knowledge workers was key to urban prosperity. Many cities tried to lure the creative class into their midst with mixed results. He was criticized as an elitist and an apologist for liberal appeals to the professional managerial class. I met him at a conference just after the 1987 stock market crash. We were the only two leftists in a room full of Wall Streeters. I liked him then and have continued to, even if I've got some criticisms of his work. Last year, he published a book with Basic that updated his theories, The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. Here he is to talk about all that. Richard Florida.
A few weeks ago, Hillary Clinton did some indiscreet bragging in which she said that she won the votes of regions with two-thirds of U.S. GDP. It didn't come off sounding very good, but she was onto something there, wasn't she?
Indeed. Indeed.
The production of GDP is far more highly regionalized than a lot of people might appreciate.
It wasn't always this way, but as long as I've been sort of tracking this, and other urban economists have been tracking it. You know, what Bill Bishop famously called the big sort, the sorting of talented and ambitious people in certain places, and the unsorting or the pushing out of less ambitious or less advantaged or more disadvantaged, less educated, more disadvantaged people of other places. And at the same time, you know, I guess Jane Jacobs taught us this. In the old industrial system, you could plant a factory just about anywhere, and not just Detroit or Pittsburgh, but a Sunbelt community, and run away from unions, you know, if you're a management, run away from high wages. And the manufacturing economy, the industrial economy, could be more decentralized. But this new knowledge economy that we have really benefits from clustering, or what urban economists call agglomeration. So it is really kind of jam-packing itself into a small subset of metro. So, you know, I think what's happened, of course, is as these certain metros, the coastal metros, the New York, Boston, Washington corridor, the Pacific Northwest with Seattle and Portland, the San Francisco Bay Area and LA, and a few places in between. I don't mean to make this so simplistic, but basically, as they've developed these powerful knowledge economies, which benefit from being open to immigration, which benefit from being more open-minded towards gay and lesbian people, which benefit from attracting young single people, which benefit from attracting talented immigrants, they've developed a more open-minded politics. So, yeah, you know, the places that voted for Mrs. Clinton, like at the metro level, the two places that cast the largest percentage of votes for Mrs. Clinton were in the Bay Area, San Francisco and San Jose. And then New York and Boston and Washington, we can go on and on about that. But basically, you know, Mrs. Clinton, like President Obama before her, captured kind of the centers of the knowledge economy, and Trump captured many more places, but he captured many of the places that are being left behind in the knowledge economy, where people are anxious about their economic situation. But I think even more than that, they're really angry at the cultural changes that they see, you know, the fact that women are treated more fairly, that gay and lesbian people have rights, that women have reproductive rights, that immigrants are allowed to come in. I think there's this sense of, you know, their old patriarchal white America is falling behind, and they're mad about that. So they voted for Trump. So, yeah, I think geography, or what I would even call spatial inequality or geographic unevenness, underpins a lot of what we see in our politics today.
Well, this contradicts a popular perception that capital is perfectly immobile and location doesn't matter like it used to, because you can do work from anywhere and, you know, factories can move all over the place, but so can office workers move all over the place. But you're saying the contrary, that place is perhaps more important than ever.
You know, from an interesting, because you're a good person to talk about this, you know, if you think about Marx writing about the industrial capitalism, modern industrial capital, that capital itself, embodied in technology, embodied in factories, embodied in dead labor, was key to making this whole system run and exploiting and taking a surplus off the backs of workers. So it was a very much an industrial economy, which pitted these two industrial classes, bourgeoisie and the proletariat, the capitalists and the workers. What I think has happened in the knowledge economy, and all I've tried to do in my life work is kind of fuse a little bit of Joseph Schumpeter and a little more of Jane Jacobs onto Marx. And maybe, you know, I've been thinking about this today, like Das Urban Kapital, you know, meaning kind of twist to play on words, Das Urban Kapital. But basically, the place itself has become the platform of this new age of knowledge capitalism, because it's not embodied in factories. It's embodied in the characteristics of places that attract this kind of knowledge worker. And talent does have some more leverage. Knowledge workers have a lot more leverage than a proletarian. So capital has to pour into these places. Big tech, if you will, in Seattle, in the Bay Area, has to pour into these places and kind of congregate and mobilize this force called knowledge workers, knowledge labor. Something Marx actually wrote about in the Grundrisse. But not, that's neither here nor there. So, yeah. It capital is still extremely mobile, but the fact is that one of the key factors of production is kind of lodged in space, in place. These very skilled knowledge workers, and in a way, it's not that they're a stock, they're a flow. And, you know, you need new ones all the time, because these knowledge skills erode very quickly, engineering skills, computer science skills, artificial intelligence. So you need a constant flow of this knowledge-based labor, if you will, knowledge-based workers into your community. And then the firms, some of them grow very large, and many of them are Schumpeterian and disrupted and fall apart. So capital is kind of lodged in place rather than captured in industrial corporations. I'm making that point over. Of course, industrial corporations are still very important. And the place itself becomes the platform. You know, sometimes I say it's supplanted the corporation. Maybe that's too strong. But the place itself becomes a platform for capitalized to mobilize this knowledge work, which is really the key source of surplus or of value creation in our economy today.
Yeah, you know, I've lived for decades now in one of these hotbeds of the knowledge economy, New York City. And you know, you mentioned earlier spatial inequality between regions, but there's certainly a lot of inequality in this particular city too. I mean, there's still an awful lot of very poor people. So the knowledge economy doesn't necessarily spread around its fruits very generously.
No, and in fact, you know, I mean, I think, you know, and I'm pretty in tune with this. You know, I'm not a neoclassical economist. I'm trained as a neo-Marxist. I'm trained as a Schumpeterian. And I think even I underestimated the divisiveness of this knowledge economy. And I never believed this trickle-down Reaganistic bullshit. But you know, looking back in the 1980s and 90s, there was this kind of romantic notion that it was a new economy and it would be more democratic. And, you know, I think I fell for this along with a lot of other people. There's a couple of wake-up calls, you know, that came due. One is obviously just looking at what's happened with gentrification in our cities, where these knowledge workers and professional people and the global super rich have poured in. So one of the things I like to say is that this spatial inequality is fractal. It occurs at every scale. It occurs across nations, regions of the world. It occurs across cities and metro areas. But it's even magnified in these superstar metros like New York or London and these knowledge hubs like San Francisco. So the only good thing, or the silver lining in that, if you can say it's a silver lining, is when you get this happening in an actual city like New York or London or Paris, it's not like all of this is in an industrial park in a gated suburb with all rich, white, educated white people who vote Republican. A city is a contested space. And yeah, you can try to gentrify it. And yeah, you can try to remake these neighborhoods. But as you said, there is still a wide diversity of ethnic and racial groups and a wide diversity of socioeconomic groups. And people getting displaced get really pissed off. So what a guy like de Blasio is dealing with, or Sadiq Khan in London, or Anne Hidalgo in Paris, or Eric Garcetti in L.A. is this new contested terrain of place. And, you know, sometimes I like to say, especially for your listeners, if the industrial corporation was the point of contestation in industrial capitalism, our cities and place itself are the point of contestation in class conflict in contemporary knowledge-based capitalism. And I end my book, The New Urban Crisis, on a realistically, you know, optimistic note, not romantically, utopian, not optimistic. But I say the one thing of having all this stuff coming back to cities, that's a silver lining, is that people are going to get mad, these class conflicts are going to erupt, and progressive mayors will be forced, will be pushed to act. Now, we need more of that, and I think a lot of these progressive mayors are full of beans. But I think we're at the beginnings of it. And as you said, a city isn't a gated suburb. It's a place that's diverse. And this inequality in cities, I think, will provoke a certain set of social movements or a certain level of contestation or class conflict that may result in better outcomes over time.
I have some confusion sometimes when you talk about knowledge workers or the creative class. Sometimes I'm not clear on whether you're talking about someone writing, you know, electronic music in a former industrial space in Bushwick, Brooklyn, or an investment banker crafting derivatives in Midtown Manhattan, or, you know, somebody writing an app in Dumbo, Brooklyn. They lead very different lives and earn very different kinds of income. So who's who in this knowledge economy?
It's a great question, and one which is at the heart of what I've grappled with all of my intellectual career. So as someone who learned Marx and is shaped by Marx, and I said a little bit by Schumpeter, a little bit by Jacobs, I like this basic division between the working class and the capitalist class. But the working class seemed not to capture, at least to me, others may argue it does, but at least in my intellectual project, the working class seemed to capture to me someone who worked with their physical labor in a factory. And if you think about that working class, I'll come back to this, it was a divided group of people. There was a group of craft workers, more artisanal, organized, you know, in union labor history terms by the AFL, who were working a little bit more with their physical skill. And they didn't like, nor did they like being lumped together initially with these mass production workers, these unskilled, largely immigrant workers that were organized by the CIO and the mass production unions. When I started to grapple with the knowledge, I had to invent this term, the creative class. People said it was post-industrial, and that didn't seem a very good term to me. And then they said that it was a service economy. And I said, well, their services, like flipping a burger at McDonald's or, you know, providing a personal service. And then there's all of these high-order services. So I was reading a passage in the Grundrisse one day, and this is where Marx talks about knowledge. Nature builds no locomotive. It builds no self-acting mules. It builds no machines. These are products of the human mind of knowledge objectified. And I was like, holy, this is intersubjective knowledge work. That's a big thing he's saying a century plus ago. So basically what I tried to do was devise a schema to think about how these knowledge workers fit in to class categories. And I read a lot of Eric Wright and a lot of other people. I'm not saying my schema is right, but it was my attempt. And so what I said was there were these group of people who work with their minds, who work with their creativity. They're as diverse as the old working class. They include more people who make derivatives. They include people who work with mathematics and people who create algorithms. They include people who write software. They include people who manage other people. They include people who work in arts, music. They don't all have high incomes, like all working class people didn't have. Some had higher incomes than others. But what makes them a class is the fact that they use knowledge as their source of production, as opposed to routine physical skill or routine manual skill in providing services, non-knowledge-based skills. So that's what I did, and I said, you know, there's about a third of the workforce, roughly speaking, much as we can estimate this, that do this kind of knowledge work. And I said, yeah, they are very different, you know, an artist and a business person, a professional, but they have something in common, which is their use of knowledge, and they are a new class. In many ways, they behave like a new class. This class, if you look at where they're located, tends to vote more Democratic. And you know, a big challenge for the work, I hate to go on and on about this, is that the white working class does not. And, you know, I don't mean to be too difficult on this, and I want dialogue with colleagues. Maybe Marx would have said the white working class has become a backward-looking class, something like the peasantry that he wrote about was a backward-looking class. And maybe there's a new class coalition to forge, which is a coalition between these knowledge workers and the even larger service class. So, you know, 65 million Americans, 45% of our workforce work in low-end, poorly compensated, precarious, highly insecure service jobs. Maybe that's the new kind of class coalition we have to forge. So that's been my intellectual project. I'm not sure I'm 100% right. I appreciate the skepticism. I appreciate critique. But I've been trying to try to define this nexus of the new class structure of knowledge-based capitalism and its embeddedness in space or place.
I'm speaking with the urban theorist Richard Florida.
No, but the three paradigmatic examples I gave, the composer, the financier, and the app writer, they all have very different politics, subjectivities, material interests. Can they be harnessed together into a class?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not an organizer, and people just said the same thing about the blacksmith and the carpenter and the welder and the assembly line person. My hunch is, you know, when I look at the data, this knowledge group tends to vote, if you aggregate them together, they tend to vote more Democratic and more small p progressive. So, yeah, I think so. I haven't looked enough at this. And the big mystery, I mean, I'm not trying to shift the question, is that, you know, we get no real statistical correlation for the service class. We get high degree of statistical correlation between the working class and kind of Trump or Romney or McCain votes. And we get a high degree of statistical correlation between concentrations of knowledge workers across these class categories in Obama or Clinton votes. But we get nothing. Maybe it's the service class is the class we have to organize. But yeah, I don't disagree with you that there are different strata within this knowledge group. I just think they if I look at their relationship to the means of production, their relationship to the means of production is their use of knowledge. That's sort of my prior on this. And that conditions at least some part of their behavior and some part of their outlook. Not totally. There are great differences in this. But at least it gives me some analytical leverage. I'm not saying it's perfect by any means.
Now, a region that doesn't get much attention that is having a lot of problems are the older inner suburbs across the country. Talk a bit about them. What's going on there and what can be done about them?
It's really interesting, you know, as someone who cares of this kind of takes this neo-Marxian outlook, that how much space is a key category that's been to some degree ignored. David Harvey and others have looked at this in great detail, but, you know, I think our class divisions are in many ways geographic divides. And, you know, as the wealthy and the affluent and the super rich and the capitalist class and these advantaged knowledge workers have poured back both into cities, the functional and desirable and close-in neighborhoods and cities, and still remain colonized in the beautiful greenbelt suburbs near mountaintops and great parks and, you know, great waterfronts. You know, the working classes and the service classes have been pushed into this uber disadvantaged neighborhoods of cities and then into these older working class suburbs that used to be, I mean, that's where I come from, right? We're just talking, we're both from Bergen County. That's where I come from. And those used to be kind of on-ramps to upward mobility if you're a worker like my dad, seventh grade education, factory worker, moved us from Newark to North Arlington, New Jersey, on-ramp to social mobility, college education for the boys and everything. Now those places are kind of desolate. They're disconnected from the economy. They're where the working classes and new immigrant groups are concentrated. They offer less avenues for upward mobility. They're the place where opioid use and other kind of drug use is skyrocketing. They're places of distress and dysfunction. And you know, this one guy at UCLA who studied at USC, Jeff Sellers, who studied this in great detail, says it's not swing states that matter in our national election. It's these dislocated, distressed swing burbs. One election they'll vote for Obama, the next election, they'll get mad and vote for Trump. And again, I haven't looked at Sellers' work in a while, but, you know, it rings true that there are these places that people just feel no one cares about them. And they're falling behind, and there's little hope for their kids. So, yeah, I think it's this, we used to talk about as urbanists, the hole in the donut. And the hole in the donut was Newark and Camden and Detroit and Pittsburgh and the inner city. The donut seems to have a new hole, and it's not in the center. You know what I'm saying? It's in these distressed burbs that are between the center of the city, which is gentrifying, and the outlying core of beautiful greenbelt suburbs that still have their hold on, you know, relatively advantaged people.
A couple of decades ago, it was going to be the Edge City. Whatever happened to that?
Joel Garreau, it's a very prescient book and a very great book. I think guys like Joel Garreau and Joel Kotkin, both of whom I've argued with vociferously, I think they have a lot to tell us. I mean, I think I may disagree with some things they say, but oftentimes they have their finger on the pulse of something quite accurate. Maybe Garreau's argument about the Edge City was appropriate for its time and maybe a bit overdrawn, that the city center city would empty and we'd have these faux city centers created. But, you know, the place he talked about, Tyson's Corner outside of D.C., is still a very wealthy place. It has among the highest incomes in the world. It has among the highest education levels in the world. You know, it's still attracting companies and people. It's not my cup of tea, but it's attracting people. And some of these, you know, Silicon Valley is an edge city that continues to work pretty well. The question is that some of these edge cities have developed into actual places, and many other edge cities, you know, have been like abandoned malls. You know, it was a phenomenon that had its day. Certain of them grew into actual places, and other of them fell by the wayside. I think the real thing that's going on, though, is there aren't a lot of places that are making it. I mentioned Tyson's Corner in Silicon Valley, but the same thing with big city centers, New York and San Francisco and Boston and Washington and Seattle. And you could say the same thing. I just wrote on rural places. You know, there's 100 rural places. There's tens of thousands of rural places across, but 100 of them seem like they're making it in the knowledge economy. So I think that the world is spiky, or advantage is concentrated at every scale. Certain big cities are making it, certain others aren't. Certain older suburbs and beautiful suburbs are making it, others aren't. Certain edge cities are making, many are falling apart. You know, I think that's the nature of the beast we have today, inequality across these many, many scales.
As is typical of these things, you always say the last 5 minutes for the what is to be done question, but how can we deal with this very serious economic but also spatial inequality? Is there any cure for it?
No. And, you know, I think we're in the most dangerous moment. I'm a pretty good student of American history. I have never could have imagined, you know, and Jane Jacobs, I always said, was the most prescient person I've ever met. She anticipated back to the city. She anticipated cities as the center of wealth generation. Her last book, Caution, Dark Age Ahead. We have a coming dark age with all these crazy reactions and populists and nationalists, and then we get Trump. I'm worried about two things. One, I'm worried about the backlash in our society and the anger and the divisiveness. Two, I'm worried that for the first time at a critical moment, when we had the Civil War, we had Abraham Lincoln. We had the Great Depression and World War II. We had Franklin Roosevelt. We have the transition to a knowledge economy and its divides. We've got freaking Trump. So I'm worried about that. But what really worries me, as a supporter of mayors and progressive mayors and a supporter of the new localism, when I look at this, pardon my French, show, which is Amazon HQ2, and I see the mayors that I admire, de Blasio and Garcetti and Peduto, and I could go on a laundry list of these guys, falling all over themselves to hand billions of dollars to a company which, by all accounts, is now a bad company. It treats its hometown Seattle bad, doesn't want to pay its taxes in Seattle, treats its workers bad. And these people falling all over themselves. So, yeah, I'm relatively gloomy. Now, do I think there's hope? Yes. But I think it's a long road, and that we're going to have to build a new kind of progressive movement from the local level up. We're going to have to limit the power of the nation state. We're going to have to make cities get some cojones and make these mayors stand up for what is right to recreate our democracy in this country and build a more – look, I'm not even going to say socialism – a more robust and decent and equitable democratic capitalism. It's a project that's really daunting, and it's going to be a long, hard road.
At the end of your book, you had some concrete proposals about, you know, housing policy and service industry pay and such. Were you just feeling some compulsion to be upbeat? Are you really this full of despair?
I don't think there's hope at the national level. I think our hope is to work with these progressive mayors I think they've disappointed a lot of us with this Amazon thing. But look, we've got to work with these progressive mayors. We've got to count on these contestations and conflicts. We've got to push as hard as we can, and we've got to create equity and inclusion at the local level. There's no way with the divide in Washington, D.C., that we're going to ever get anything done. But yeah, could we make San Francisco more inclusive? Hopefully. Could New York become a beacon of hope and progress? Yes. Could my own Toronto become a better place? Probably. And Detroit and Pittsburgh. I think we're going to, as people who care about a better future, we're going to have to push hard at the local level, and we're going to have to work with our enemies, you know, people on the right, who are also saying, look, Washington is dysfunctional. Let's devolve power to the local level. I'm optimistic, but in the very long run, I think we've got some real struggles ahead of us. And I'm worried about the state of the progressive movement. I really am worried about it. But look, I mean, my dad was born in a Great Depression and fought in World War II and that fought the fascists. And we came out of that in a better place. So yeah, at the end of the day, I'm optimistic. I mean, but who could sit here in the face of Trump and Amazon HQ2 and just say, look, everything's rosy? We're in a tough moment in American history and in world history, and we've got to buck up.
And let's hope the climate cooperates.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that upbeat note. We've gone through these moments before. We've come out somewhat better off. These struggles are endemic to human history, and we've just got to point the finger in a progressive direction.
That was the urban theorist Richard Florida. His book, The New Urban Crisis: How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It, was published in hardcover last year and is now just out in paperback from Basic. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Righteous Woman by Torres, the stage name of Mackenzie Scott. Till next week, bye. Street.